You're listening to the Culture Builders Podcast. Conversations with experts in culture, change and people. Underpinned by lessons in well-being for teams and individuals.
Hello, I'm Jane Sparrow, founder and author of The Culture Builders. And this marks the beginning of our series of change leadership lessons. So as many of you know listening, we are experts in change, in culture, and in anything people related. And as part of that, have the honour of working with many leaders, many organisations to enable them, their leaders, their teams to successfully navigate change. And of course, change is around us constantly. So it's a fairly topical conversation for many. And as part of that, what we're keen to do is gather some of the best, strongest, most interesting leaders that we've worked with over the years to share some of their key lessons, those little nuggets, those little moments that they reflect on that will be useful to anyone listening who's got a role in change. So that's our aim today. And I'm joined by one of my favourite people. And I remember meeting this person on a conference platform. He was talking about gorillas that played music, and I was talking about the launch of the Culture Builders book. So it was quite a few years ago, but I'm going to let him say a little bit more about his background and why gorillas are so important. So welcome, Phil Rumble. Fantastic to have you with us. Thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Great to be talking to you. So yeah, a bit about my background. So I'm currently a non-exec director and advisor. But prior to that, I was chief executive for Bolson, the German family-owned biscuit company, famous for their Choco Leibniz biscuits. I've also co-founded and sold my own company, and before that held a variety of senior marketing and commercial roles for the likes of Cadbury, AB InBev, and Whitbread. And that's the link to your gorilla reference. So I was at Cadbury when we got a gorilla playing the drums to sell more chocolate. And I think that's really about how you engage people, consumers in that case, but I think there are parallels between that and internal engagement and change.
Definitely. And who doesn't remember the gorilla playing the drums? I certainly smile every time I think about it. So, Phil, I know you were the mastermind behind that. And your point there around that was an example of engagement really speaks to me around my experience of you over the years as being just how passionate you are about ensuring people are engaged throughout business, throughout life, but certainly through any kind of change. And I know you've worked on both sort of growth and transformational change. You've also had to work on structural change and changing the way that businesses operate. So keen to drill into some of that. But as you said, you've also run your own businesses and you've had a journey that you've gone on with those. So what I love about talking to you today is being able to draw upon your experience as CEO of a major brand, and by the way, who doesn't love Leibniz biscuits as well, but also being able to lead smaller organisations, help them grow and the change associated with that, and then change of ownership as we go. So let's dig into that a little bit and just tell us a little bit more about the types of change that you've experienced and led through your career, and maybe some of your early memories to start with of some of that change experience.
I've had experience of a broad spectrum of different types of change. So as CEO of Bolson, I led a major company-wide review and change of the overall operating model and the culture of that business, which is an international business across 3,000 people. I've also led many organizational design and restructuring projects. I've also been a leader in four companies that have been acquired and had to lead teams transitioning from one company to another. And also, led the change that comes from building a company from four people to 50. So I think I've had experience of growth, resizing, M&A, and quite a broad spectrum of changes that can happen to people in an organization.
And from all of that, because there's such richness to draw upon, tell us about perhaps one of your early memories of maybe being in a fairly new leadership role as opposed to now when you're a little bit more seasoned, and something you remember there that helped inform how you led change, how you engaged people moving forwards.
I think probably my biggest reflection was when I led change for the first time. It's very easy to get fixated on the change that you want to make, and the sort of design of things and the process of things, and forget that ultimately you're trying to change the behavior of people. And that focus on the people rather than the process and the design was something that I sort of, the more I've done it, the more I've understood that is actually the key to it. And if necessary, you can change the design, you can change the process, but if you get people, you know, moving, and that's at its most simplistic level, the way I think about change is to get a group of people to move from A to B. And so that's really what you need to keep focusing on. How can you get people to move and change?
And when they're human beings, of course, as well. So it doesn't always go according to plan, does it? But I mean, I'm totally aligned with you there in terms of the belief and the behaviour piece, because as we know, working together over the years, those three pillars that we talk about in terms of what we believe, how we behave and what we use, and the use is the process piece. And so often people focus on the process, don't they? And so that lesson you learn early on must have put you in good stead, in that, you know, it's the people that you really need to focus on, and that behavior. So tell us a little bit more about where you tend to put your energy then, and how do you take those people from A to B, probably via C and D on the way sometimes. What are some of the lessons you've learned?
Over the years, I think I've had some really good role models and mentors for change, and I've picked up some things along the way from those people and also from my own experience. So maybe if I talk about some of those key principles, and I think the first amongst those is, I remember somebody saying something to me years ago, which was, you need to provide vision for the architects and concrete for the builders. And this is, I think, about two things. It's about having a clear narrative about what you're doing, the change you're trying to drive, and importantly, why you're doing it. But it's also a recognition that in any group of people, whether it's 10 people, 100 people, or 1,000 people, different people will need different things during that change. And therefore, you need to communicate different things. And the vision for the architects is, you know, some people would buy into a big vision and the concept of what you're trying to do, whereas other people are left sort of scratching their head going, I think I know what he means, but I'm not sure. And for those people, you need to give much more concrete examples to enable them to engage with it. So that was just a really valuable lesson for me, because I tend to be more on the sort of conceptual side, and it was, you know, early on, I'd probably focus more on the big picture, the big vision, and didn't make it concrete enough for people. So I think that's been a mantra of mine for a number of years.
And Phil, just on that, as you've gone, I mean, and kind of tailored that message and that approach, how have you done that when you've had maybe a small team? I can see how it would work if you're, you know, in your CEO role and you're thinking about a big number of people. How did you become much more mindful around tailoring that message when you had perhaps had a smaller team, when you were perhaps in your first or second key leadership role?
Yeah, actually, probably the best example of that was actually when I co-founded and set up my own company. And what we were trying to do was, we had a vision for that business and we wanted to do things differently. And within that was supply change for the people that joined the business. And I remember that when I first set about doing that, I said to my partners, you know, we need to get people together regularly, talk about the vision for the business, tell them how we're doing, and so on. And they looked at me a bit blankly, why would we need to do that? And anyway, I managed to persuade them, but I remember the first couple of times I tried to do that, I did it in a more big company kind of way. So front of the room with PowerPoint, and I could tell it just didn't work. And so what I learned was that, you know, in a situation where you've got smaller groups of people and also different types of people, so these weren't typically people from a big corporate background, what was more important was to have a conversation, to talk about the vision, but do it in a more conversational way, and to talk about examples of what that might look like and engage them in a discussion on those things in a much more informal conversational way.
Yeah, and I know I've seen you do that at both as large scale but also smaller scale with people, and just being able to adapt to that conversation and see people kind of engage in a deeper way. You know, they perhaps need to see that vision, but then being able to engage in a deeper way, I've seen you do with my own eyes. So really interesting that you reflect on that. So thank you. Tell us more, because I interrupted you when you were in full flow.
If you do that, if you've got the vision and you've got examples, what I've learned is you still need to expect that it will still be a bit vague and unclear to people. And so one of the things that I learned when I practiced when I was at Cadbury was what I would call be prepared to get your boots on and play. So if, to use a sporting analogy, you see yourself as the coach, as a leader of change, and you're trying to get the team to play to some new tactics, you can explain those new tactics on a blackboard in the changing room as much as you like. But sometimes what you actually need to do is get your boots on and actually play the game with the team to bring it to life. So an example of that was when I was at Cadbury, and what I was trying to do was to get people to tap into that spirit of Willy Wonka and a more what we call inspirational marketing approach. So marketing that inspired consumers. People, I could go, yeah, okay, I get it. I get what you're trying to do, but I don't know how to get it. And so what I chose to do was to pick a handful of projects where I said to the team, I'm going to be involved with the team in the project, so I could role model the behaviors that I felt we needed, and people could see it in action and could learn from that as well. And yeah, I found that experience at Cadbury was really, really powerful, because it was only really when people saw that in action that they really got it, and it really started to take on deeper meaning.
I love that saying, be prepared to get your boots on and play. And I'm just wondering, Phil, in that example, if you're a more senior leader, as I know you were at Cadbury and have been since, and you go into that area and you start to role model and you get a little bit perhaps deeper, how do you signal to the rest of the business so that they don't feel like they're unloved and less wanted? Because people get quite vulnerable, don't they? And they feel quite emotional during change. So there is a risk. People then sort of feel like they're not in the spotlight. How have you learned to manage that in the past?
Yeah, well, I think there's probably different ways you can do that. But if I maybe talk about the Cadbury example, what I did was we developed a vision for the team, and then some clear priorities, that the strategy that came out of that. And then the areas where I chose to get my boots on and play were aligned to those priorities. So they've been called out as business priorities, if you like, and a key part of the strategy. And also the priorities spanned a number of different teams and a number of different initiatives. So I think in that case, it would have been hard for people to say, well, you know, why is still focusing on these things but not our area of the business? But I think, you know, more generally, it's just about signaling what you're doing. So in that instance, it was about choosing to get more involved more executionally, and you can't do that on everything, so certainly not everything straight away. So I think it's just telling people what you're doing and why, so that they understand that, yeah, it can't be on everything, and it should ideally be aligned to the things that are most important, you know, in driving the outcomes that you're looking for.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. And therefore, so much of this is about communication, isn't it? Signalling and engaging and communicate. So there's a lesson there around role modelling. There's a lesson that you learn early on around tailoring the message. Give us something else that you learned earlier in your career that you continue to apply.
One of the things that someone told me, which the first time I heard it, I just intuitively thought, I'm not sure about that, but I've actually learned the truth and the wisdom of it, which is it's very easy when you're leading a change to focus on the people that are most resistant. And I remember this person saying to me, Phil, what you need to do is focus as much at on the people at the front of the group that are moving as those at the back. And I think that's important, because going back to my analogy of it's about getting people to go from A to B, and it's about movement. The more you can get a sense of momentum that the group is moving, and a sense of peer momentum, the more chance you've got of the group being affected by that. And so I think it's really important to identify those people who you think do get it, do want it, and can be part of that change, and to identify them, encourage them, thank them, give them a role in helping to lead the change. So that's not to say you ignore the people that are at the back of the pack, but I think maybe before I got that bit of advice, I was guilty of focusing too much on the people that were resisting the change and not really putting as much effort into the people that were likely to sort of pick it up and run with it.
Yeah, and so often we see exactly that, where the effort goes into almost a kind of frustration of, I need to get the people moving that are at the back or resisting, when actually, if we're not careful, those that are embracing and moving at the front then slow down, don't they? Because they haven't got the ongoing belief, or they didn't internalize it fully because we haven't given them that space. And so I couldn't agree more. I think there's a massive piece there around momentum in change, and a leader's job in creating and then keeping the right level of momentum. And of course, sometimes, I guess you would agree, you do need to slow it down a bit, because people can run too fast without properly digesting what it might mean for them, and then they stall later. So it's appropriate pace and momentum, isn't it? But really making sure that you keep it moving, keep focused on those at the front, rather than losing connection to them and just going for the ones at the back. I think that's really, really sound advice.
And also having a goal to build the leadership group, make it as big and as broad as possible, as quickly as possible. So, you know, coming back to the culture builders, that idea of change isn't led just top down, it's led down and across the organisation. So particularly identifying people who are early adopters or advocates that are more junior and cover a spectrum of roles, I've seen the truth and the power in that as well.
Yeah, and not just going for the seniors, needing to take them with you, but also finding those other movers, shakers, advocates, influencers throughout the business. And looking, I know we've looked in the past at communities that already exist, haven't we, when you've gone into newer businesses, and how can we quickly utilise those rather than having to build new communities as well. Now, the other thing that I know that you mentioned and is very true about you is that lots of the businesses you've led and been involved with have been acquired in some way. And many listening will have had that experience, or perhaps mergers, so similar experiences. And I'd love to tap into some of your lessons and any advice you could give there of how you lead people when there is an acquisition, because that has all sorts of different dimensions, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it does. If I think about this point and more generally, you know, how I lead in change, I think it's quite heavily informed by my background in marketing. And so what I mean by that is, I think what I've learned to do is, first and foremost, put yourselves in the shoes of the people that the change is happening to and around. And so if I think about that in the context of a business that's been acquired, and as I said, I've been leader in four different businesses that have been acquired. The way I think about that is, I think good people choose good companies, and there's that sort of emotional contract between them. When someone is part of a business that's acquired, I think the most important thing to remember is they haven't chosen that change, and they haven't chosen that company. And if you start from that place of recognizing that, and then thinking about how can you start to build or put the foundations of a new emotional contract between those people and the new organization, number one. And number two, how can you help them to understand the change and adapt to it? I think that will stand you in really good stead.
And great advice. When you talk about creating that new emotional contract, give us a sense of how you've seen that done well, because that makes complete sense in theory, doesn't it? But in terms of how one might do that, rather than waiting for the entire organisation to move on it, but, you know, what power have you got as a leader to do something there?
Yeah, well, I think this links into one of the other principles that I've found is really important, which is, you know, to borrow another sort of advertising phrase, it's good to talk, and, you know, the importance of empathy. And I remember years ago somebody, you know, talking to me about the difference between sympathy and empathy. And so this idea that empathy is about showing compassion and really understanding how other people are feeling. So I think coming back to the sort of the acquisition scenario, I think it starts with acknowledging that people didn't choose this, and showing some compassion and understanding of that. And then going into a conversation about what's important to them in the relationship they have with the company that they work for, what are their hopes for the new organization, and also what are their fears, so that you can start to understand the aspects of the new company that you might be able to draw their attention to and to get them to see the virtues of, at the same time as understanding what they might be fearful about. So, you know, if those fears are unfounded, you can work at trying to sort of, you know, give them a different perspective. Or if those fears have some foundation, you can be working, you know, in the new organization to address some of those fears and do something about it. So, but I think it all starts with this idea of empathy and encouraging people to talk about how they're feeling, so that you can start from where they are currently and then think about how you can get them to a more positive place, and particularly get them to see the things in the new organization that they might like and might be emotionally drawn to. But when something is done to you, that's probably the last thing in your mind, to look for those things.
And where you've done that, Phil, I assume, you know, there's a lot of effort goes into doing that at the beginning, in your experience, certainly it is in mine. How have you learned, and how have you seen others have success, and have you had success with keeping that going? So, you know, you have that initial conversation, it's good to talk, you have that empathy, you start coaching them on that journey and listening and changing yourself too, in terms of some of the things that might need to happen. But after that first couple of weeks, how do you keep that going? How do you keep that level of connection, and how do you keep that engagement in the change positively?
Well, I think there comes a point when you have to go from the collective conversation to more of an individual conversation. So one of the things that I've done in acquisition is to make sure that there's a follow-up at an individual level, to check in with people, to understand how they're feeling, what's going well, what's not. And when the company that I co-founded that was sold, it was 50 people. I made a point of having regular one-to-ones with all of those 50 people over the 12 months that followed to have those conversations. Now, obviously, when you're in a bigger organization, that's not possible. But what I think it's about doing is highlighting that that's an important thing to do, role modeling it with your direct reports, and then encouraging them to do the same with their teams, so that it's not just a conversation up front about contemplating what the new landscape might be like. It's you're checking in 3 months, 6 months, 12 months down the line to see how it's turning out in reality for them.
Yeah, and I guess what goes with that is your point around encouraging the leaders within the business to do that perhaps are kind of, I hate the phrase, but beneath you in the hierarchy. But also being really clear on what you expect from them, and that leading people through a period of acquisition and the change that goes with that is part of their job, and being really clear on what you expect of those around you.
Yes. The other part of it, actually, as I think about your question, which might sound counterintuitive and maybe a bit different, dangerous, is in those conversations, in those one-to-one conversations, my mindset has always been I'm there to serve the needs of the individual, not the interests of the company. And what I mean by that is to have a conversation about the individual and sort of where they are and their career. And I suppose really kind of either implicitly or explicitly say to them, there comes a point when you as an individual need to decide whether this is the right place for you. And people can't force that on you. And after 6, 9, 12 months, you'll know. And, you know, sometimes those conversations go in the direction of people saying, yeah, actually, you know, it's better than I thought. I can see the opportunity. I'm thriving. And sometimes people say, I'm still not comfortable. It's not, you know, it's not what I want. And then that's where I will, you know, the conversation will more be about them and what they need and what they need to do. So I think also, particularly coming back to what I said with an acquisition, where it's, you know, a company they didn't choose, I think it's about making people feel that they've got a choice, they've got some agency in that whole process, you know, and the ultimate choice is, once they've seen what the new landscape is like, whether they want to stay or not.
Yeah, because ultimately it goes back to your point just now, it's not being or not feeling like it's being done to you, but that it's being done with, isn't it? And that choice, that feeling you have a choice, is so critical. Now, the other thing I'm intrigued about is, you know, that's great advice for if you are in an organisation that has been acquired. What about if you're acquiring? I'm wondering, if I was someone acquiring your organisation, What might I want to think about with you as the CEO of that acquired organisation or a senior leader? What might I be able to do for that organisation coming in to better support and better lead that change?
So having experienced M&A on both sides, I think there's a natural tendency for it to revert to a bit of a victors and vanquished dynamic. So the people acquiring are the victors, they've won, and the people that have been acquired are the vanquished and they've lost. And I think if you're the business acquiring a business, I think it's really helpful to be mindful of that. And it's not necessarily through anything you've said or done, but that's just how people will be feeling. And so having real humility as the acquiring company and going overboard to say, okay, we've acquired this company, we've acquired you, but I'm sure there's a huge amount that we can learn from and to get the best of both organisations. As I said, because there will be that tendency to view it in the way that I've said as sort of victors and vanquished, I think you have to work really hard to signal humility, to ask questions, to listen and take on board so that the new organisation feels like it's the best of both rather than just complete takeover.
Yeah, and that listening part really being genuine, I would imagine too. So I've seen that happen really well where we've set up conversations and said, well, you know, how does this work in both organisations? How does that work? And be really practical things that help people to see the difference, but also the commonality. And people listening to that and kind of thinking, okay, great. Well, so what do we do with that that's helpful? As opposed to, you know, just tell me how you're feeling. And that being a sort of almost like a token thing to tick the box and say we're doing.
Exactly. I think you need to be able to, certainly in your own mind and potentially sort of signal it to others, be clear on what are the manifestations of that best of both intention. So whether it's the top team, is it comprised of members from both organizations or is it just the people that were in the acquiring company? The ways of working, the way you do things. So I think in terms of people, ways of working, culture, I think you need to be able to point to some things and say, no, actually these things came from the organization that was acquired, and to really signal that those things have made the new combined entity stronger and better for that. Because as you say, if it's just an exercise in showing empathy, listening, but not really doing anything differently, that will wear thin pretty quickly.
So those proof points are really critical, aren't they, along the journey? So listening at the beginning, but then having some real high profile proof points that you can talk about on the way. Yeah. Phil, thank you so much. There's so much in what you've talked about from your experience, and I know there's so much more, but this will give people some real practical things to think about. And I feel it'll almost be a bit of a checklist for people if they're leading change right now or if they might be leading more significant change in the future to have, and some great sound bites around boots and emotional contracts to remember too. Just to end, if you would, by just giving us perhaps, what's your one lesson, if you had to pick one, that you continue to take forward yourself as a leader, as you'll continue to influence and lead businesses, that you really live by as you continue to be in a world of change? To give us one core thing that really is part of your mantra and who you are that you feel it's worth sharing with others that they could learn from.
I think it links back to the last point I was saying, really, which is, I think as a leader of change, if you can understand your personal motivation for driving the change, that will make you so much more powerful and authentic as a leader of that change. And back to your point, if that motivation isn't immediately apparent, then try to find something, think about it in ways where you can see why you might want to do it, because it's very hard to ask other people to change and be motivated to change if you yourself aren't. And so it starts with thinking about, why am I doing this?
Phil, thank you so much for joining us today and kicking off our series with some really, really significant and practical golden nuggets. We'll have you back on again, I'm sure, and talking further. But for now, thank you. And we hope you continue to have the influence you've always had in the businesses that you're leading and advising now.
Great. Well, thanks for the opportunity to chat about it. As you can probably tell, it's a subject that's close to my heart. So, yeah, I was very happy to chat to you about it.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. Continue the journey at theculturebuilders.com.